Welcome to the AquariMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 103, recorded March 5th, 2012. Hello, everybody.
Greetings, all.
We are back. So, you have an announcement for us.
I do. We just released a new video. It's on goldfish breeding tubercles. As just a quick guide to recognizing them, and it's got some shots so that those people who would like to be able to recognize goldfish breeding tubercles can now do so.
Tell us exactly what those are while we're on the subject, because well, how often do you run across the word
tubercles? Only in certain circles. Well, basically, male goldfish have them in certain seasons. When they're in breeding condition, they tend to have them, and so people see them, and sometimes they wonder what they are. Sometimes they think they're ick, because they do look a little bit like that. Goldfish aren't the only fish that have them. A lot of cyprinids, fish in the goldfish family, have something like that when they're in breeding condition. But goldfish are one of the most commonly kept cyprinids, of course, being one of the most commonly kept aquarium fish. So there you go.
Okay, so it's what they are and a little bit of a hint of how you can tell your goldfish might be a male.
Yeah, and you can't always tell, because you can have a goldfish that's a male that doesn't have them. But if it does have them, then you know it's a boy.
Then it's a boy.
Yeah.
Okay. So today we are going to hear from Anne in Pittsburgh and Ken and Juliet and Mick.
Right.
Shall we start?
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to talk to Anne, well, hear from Anne first. I remember last week we talked about her question. She wanted to kind of switch tanks, like upgrade to a bigger tank.
Yeah, she started with the 30. That's what she's got now, and she wants to upgrade to a 45 of the same footprint.
But she wants to put everything that's in the 30 into the 45. So same substrate, same fish, same decor.
Right, so we asked her some questions about that last time, or a couple of times ago. But anyway, she's gotten back to us on some of our questions.
And we talked about it last week, too. What did we...
We did start talking about it, yes.
Okay. So, she emailed us back about her filters. She says, I have a canister filter and lots of plants, and I have never had a water quality issue that I know of. It did not occur to me that all that new water and possibly changes in temperature and parameters in that great a quantity may affect the biofilter.
Yeah, so I guess it's good that we brought that up, mm-hmm. because that can definitely be an issue, so something to be approached with caution.
And she says, also, the issue of anaerobic areas in the sand is an interesting one. I am attached to my substrate.
Yeah, I did ask about that, how attached she was to her substrate. Mm-hmm. So do tell. Tell us a little bit more about what she says about that.
She says it is a mix of Eco Complete on the bottom for the plants and black Tahitian moon sand on the top. That's pretty.
It is.
So it was a little expensive.
It's pretty stuff.
It's about 2 to 3 inches deep. Some of the areas with plants are a little deeper than some of the other areas. About half is rooted with plants. Some are extensively rooted, maybe a quarter.
So maybe a quarter of the surface of the mm-hmm. substrate has extensively rooted plants in it.
And another quarter is easily transplanted dwarf baby tears, and the rest is loosely rooted plants like I'm assuming Vals is short for Valsinaria.
Right.
Or open sand and rocks and wood and, you know, mm-hmm. furniture.
Yeah.
She says, I think the sand is pretty loose where there aren't roots. It has been set up for about 3 years.
Okay, well, that does help quite a bit. But let's see what else she has to say about that first before we give some ideas about that.
She says, in terms of grain size, the Eco-Complete seems a mix of larger grain, maybe the size of small pebbles with very fine grain. I cannot see the grain size, so that must be pretty fine. The moon sand is about granulated sugar size grains.
Okay. Well, a few things we can talk about here. One is, if you are attached to the substrate, as you say, and you've got two different types of substrate, that is going to be pretty complicated. And I think it's...
How would you even get the... I mean, moon sand, it's like sand.
It is sand,
it's
yes.
not like you can pick up
individual
rocks
grains.
Or pieces of gravel, even. How
right.
How would you get that out without it just mixing all into what is underneath it?
Well, yeah, you're going to get some mixing. I don't think that's avoidable at all.
You can't really. It's kind of like trying to scrape frosting off the cake once you've already frosted it.
Right, in a sense it is. And you can scoop some of it off,
some of the Tahitian moon sand, you could probably scoop the bulk of it off, but there's no way you can prevent some of that sand from falling down into the eco-complete. You could even siphon some of it off if you have a fairly large bore piece of flexible tubing and starting a siphon. The sand is light enough, you'd be able to siphon some of it off into a bucket, maybe most of it even, as long as you've got enough water in there to, you know, keep the siphon going. You could siphon a lot of it off and then move the eco-complete by scooping it out. It's a long and painstaking process. So
it's a long and glorious tradition.
Yeah,
there's
so...
another one.
There you go. So you'd have to make sure that you have the ability to keep the fish and everybody, the plants, happy somewhere else while you're doing this, which is no small task. Although if you have a canister filter, the nice thing is you can just unhook the canister filter and hook it onto a different container. Where you're keeping the fish temporarily,
like if you
while you're
in
doing
a bucket
it.
Or a
yeah.
big tub or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, you could do something like
that. Or a
bathtub,
that's not what I meant.
Like no, but you have like a big Rubbermaid tub or something, like a trough, like a horse trough or something like that. You had them hooked up to, you know, something like that. While you're doing that, and you could heat that and everything, keep them pretty happy with the filter while you're doing it, and put the plants into bags or a bucket or something like that. That might help. You'd still... like I said, you'd get some of the Tahitian moon sand would be mixed in with the eco-complete, but it would probably work tolerably well. And with the plants, as you described, it'll be easy to reroute some of them, like the valves and the dwarf baby's tears, and then the crypts or whatever they are that may be crypts, just pulling them up carefully, you know, pulling out the mat of roots and then sort of replanting that mat of roots later, or cutting them, separating them carefully and then replanting them in different places could work too. But that could work. It's not an easy project, but it could be done.
Okay. She goes on to say, like you said in the podcast, it's more for the aesthetics and aquascaping potential of the extra top space and getting rid of that chip in the glass that I like the idea of. The few extra gallons maybe will help fish capacity or give the schooling fish more space to get away from the breeding rams.
Yeah, and the few extra gallons are a good thing, definitely. And I may have given the impression that they weren't last time. I hope I didn't. But they're just not as... because the footprint's not changing, they're not as useful as they would be if the footprint were becoming larger.
Right.
That was what I meant to say. But it will make some difference in terms of... you know,
it's still more space.
Still more gallons and more space for certain fish and so on. So, yeah. And definitely the chip in the glass is something you do want to address if you can.
Because that's a little scary.
Yeah.
She has a little bit of more news about her rams who had been spawning. She says they lost the second spawn that they tried again on the not quite flat leaf. She said it was really interesting to watch the dad. She said he was devotedly picking up the fry from the bottom and putting them back on the leaf all night. What a good daddy. However, thinking out my floating guppy grass that was making an overhanging cave over that leaf did encourage them to find a new spot. I had made a rock cave on the other side of the tank, and they spawned behind that, between the rocks and the side glass of the tank, and dug their own sand pit for the eggs. They're at the wriggler stage now. Hopefully this one is more successful. Needless to say, I won't try to switch tanks for a while if the fry survive.
And that, of course, is a good idea. You don't want to upset the parents when they're... taking care of fry, or, you know, moving fry can be tricky too. So that is sounds like they've made some progress. Hopefully they'll pull through this time. So let us know.
That's great.
And it's been a few days since this message came in, so maybe by now she's got free-flowing fry. I hope so.
Oh, and she has a comment on the new mics.
Good.
It's kind of funny. She says, I literally jumped and sat up straight when you first started the podcast, and then did it again when Kelly came on later. I was using earbuds, and your voice came in on the left at first with the music on both sides. At that point, for some reason, it sounded tinny or far away. Then when Kelly came on later, her voice, which was now crystal clear, was on the left and yours was on the right. And they were both so clear, it was almost funny, like you were sitting on either side of me talking about fish.
Well, it's good to know that the mics are working out. We are still working on some of the... yeah, we're working on some of the fine-tuning, but it sounds like the mics are keepers. From your comment and the comments of several others, which we'll probably encounter later on in the show. But it's good to know, and we will try to work on fine-tuning to make sure that your listening experience is as positive as possible.
Okay, so thank you, Anne, and good luck with all that. Okay, moving on, we had a comment from Ken from Prince of Ponds.
And Pet Tech Podcast.
And we actually have some fun projects in the works.
Yes, we'll be excited to let you know more about those in the future.
But he did want to let us know that the sound quality sounds better, so that's good to know.
Yes, so thank you for letting us know that. Load off our minds that several people have mentioned that.
Mm-hmm. Mick also, who we're going to next, said that.
Okay, good.
Mick in Carnforth. So he has some goldfish comments relating to Robert's goldfish. What was it? It swallowed something insane.
An otocinclus. That's scary.
Yeah, that's like, go swallow a whole chicken.
Yeah, I haven't tried that recently.
Not pleasant. Maybe it could be like Mr. Bean, you know, he gets the turkey stuck on his head. He could just get the otocinclus stuck around his head next time.
There you go.
Okay. So Mick says, on the subject of fish swallowing stuff, I once had a parrot cichlid that had swallowed an elastic band I had used to tie some java fern onto a bogwood. I managed to net it out and, using tweezers, gently pull the band out of his mouth, which turned out to be around 3 inches long. He was none the worse for the event and now lives with someone else and, as far as I know, is still going strong.
Yep, I had a very similar incident myself. So, in my case, it was a guppy that had swallowed one, but it was actually...
It swallowed a rubber band?
Yes.
How does a guppy even fit a rubber band inside of
itself? Well, the rubber band had broken. It was also used to attach anubias or java fern or something.
So it was like a piece of a rubber band?
It was a long one. It had just broken in one spot, so it was just a long string of elastic.
Rubber spaghetti.
Yes, and the guppy swallowed it, and it went all the way through its digestive system, except it had about, I don't know, a centimeter or so sticking out of its mouth and a centimeter or so sticking out somewhere else.
Oh, my goodness. And which end did you pull it out of?
Well, I ended up cutting it off on one end and then pulling some out of the mouth, and then the rest of it came out on its own, and the guppy was fine afterwards, but yeah. So it's nice to know that Mick's fish survived it, my fish survived it, and hopefully Mr. Wiggles is still doing okay, too.
That just sounds painful.
Yeah.
Okay, so thank you for the anecdote.
And the moral of the story for all you fish listening out there, don't swallow rubber bands.
Don't
They're not that good anyway.
Things. Yes. Okay, who are we hearing from next? Juliet in Paris. She's
yes.
She's got some shrimp issues again, I guess.
Well, she's sort of finding out a resolution to some shrimp issues she's having, but has some further follow-up questions.
Excellent. And she says in her email, water quality and overfeeding. That's about the gist of it. My water quality is excellent, even though I would prefer a lower pH. I am guessing that overfeeding and the lack of some important substances are probably what is stopping the shrimp from molting properly and dying off, especially considering the buried females.
Yeah, so she had mentioned earlier that she's having problems losing mostly buried females from her red cherry shrimp and was really trying to figure out what it was and had found some good online resources, and she's finding that generally, these problems stem from either poor water quality or overfeeding, or I guess both. And she's saying in her case, it is probably overfeeding.
Because her water quality is pretty good.
Yeah.
She says, I have slowed down the feeding and especially have limited the amount of animal protein the shrimp were getting. They absolutely adored the sinking fish tubs, but I have now switched almost entirely to specialized shrimp pellets, added vegetables, and better nori, the chic kind, which incidentally they much prefer to the black flake kind I had before.
Good.
I also don't feed them every day.
Good. I'm glad the sheet nori is working for you. That's when we suggested the sheet style of nori, and that's the one I use, and I'm glad it's working out.
It's the one you eat, too.
Yeah, I love that stuff.
It just eats a whole sheet of it just by itself.
Yeah.
These shrimp are sakura, and it is possible that I have only females. All of mine are fire red, even those who shape-wise look more like males. Do you know if male sakura are as red as the females? These are all grown-up juveniles from a previous birth, so I would have expected some males, but the lack of eggs and the high color making me doubt this now.
Well, in general, as Juliet knows, but for our other listeners who may not know this, red cherry shrimp males are not quite as intensely colored as the females. When you get one that looks really, really red, it's almost certainly a female.
Hmm.
And the males have some red in them, but not nearly as much. Oh, well, let's take a break, and then we'll resume this conversation about red cherry shrimp.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Nine.
Okay, we are back, and we are talking about red sakura shrimp and Juliet's questions from Paris.
Okay. And sakura red is really, it's just a color variety of red cherry shrimp, and it's one that is considered to be very red, more so than some of the other color varieties. And there is a lot of variability out there, just for those of you who haven't kept them, might be wondering about that. I'm not sure if the males are as colorful as the females in sakura variety or not. I know that in general, red cherry shrimp males are just not as red. So if you see a really red shrimp in most cultivars, it is not nearly as brightly or richly colored, but I'm not sure about the sakura reds. However, Mick is, because Mick keeps them. So, Mick, why don't you let us know what you think about that? Would you consider the males as colorful as the females or not? Oh, and you could also check out Mick's video on YouTube. We go back a couple of episodes to where we have a link to his YouTube channel, and you can see his tank full of sakura reds and check out the males and the females.
And I don't think he points out in the video this is a male and this is a female, but she could
Juliet,
get a visual idea of, oh, none of mine look like that, so.
Right, she could probably get an idea just by looking at it with her experience with male and female sakuras already, and that could be helpful. So,
she is wondering about, if she does only have females. She says, I might have to add a normal red cherry shrimp male to this lot to see if I get more eggs. So far, one female might be buried, but it's early stages yet. A few seem to have saddles, but are not becoming buried. Do you know if female shrimp can remain fertilized long after all males have left the tank? It could be that the buried one was fertilized before the last two male died, and it is possible that I now only have females.
Well, I could be wrong on this, but my understanding is that red cherry shrimp can only mate for a short window right after they have molted. And this has to do with the anatomy, and it actually changes shape a short time after the molt, so there's a little window of mating time there. And that each time that they produce a clutch of eggs, they need to be able to mate to do that. There are a lot of species out in the world that don't, like guppies, for example. They can produce a lot, a clutch
coming.
Of young. Yeah, after one mating, they can produce something like 8 clutches of young or something.
Wow.
But as far as I know, red cherry shrimp have to mate each time.
Okay, so if she does turn out to be buried, then there has to be a male in there somewhere.
There must be a male somewhere around. There was very recently.
She says, I would rather not add a normal red cherry shrimp to this incredibly red lot of sakuras, but the shop only seems to have identically colored shrimp, so please give me your thoughts on this before I downgrade the quality of my stock in order to breed from them. So, mixing stock.
Yeah, well, we'll have to wait and see what Mick says about the males, but I would say mixing stock, it certainly has potential for reducing the intensity of color in subsequent generations. But on the other hand, people do work with shrimp like this, and sakura red shrimp, as far as I know, were just selectively bred from the normal red variety and intensified by selective breeding. And you could do the same thing, and it might take a few generations, and you might decrease the redness of your stock, but you will be able to get redder stock subsequently just by carefully selecting out the ones you want and putting them in the tank, in the breeding tank, as it were. I know that I have mixed wild colored shrimp with my red cherry shrimp on occasion, and was able to get, really red ones out after a few generations. It does dilute things for a while, but you can get there eventually.
How long is a shrimp generation?
Not very long. Shrimp are just a few months old when they start breeding. So
not really
not terribly long. No.
Okay. She has another question, which is interesting. She says, if this female does turn out to be buried, then I shall raise the young first, hoping for males. Do you know if temperature or water hardness affects the sex ratio in red cherry shrimp?
Not sure about that one. That's a great question. If any of you out there know of any studies on that topic, let me know. As far as I've been able to tell, just anecdotally, from my own tanks, keeping them at various temperatures and types of water conditions, I haven't noticed any difference. But then I haven't been being empirical about it either, so... That's a great question.
Well, that is something good to think about, since there are so many species that temperature or whatever affects how many males and how many females you get. So
yeah, that's true. There are a lot of species like that, like cribs, which doesn't Julia have a question about cribs too?
Yeah, she has an update really on her cribs for us. She says, sadly, the crib fry disappeared one by one over a period of 2 weeks, though they were healthy, active, and feeding. An Amano shrimp got one. Perhaps they hunted them at night and ate them all. Corys and coolies didn't seem to be a problem, but I'm never really sure about coolies. At night, they become tigers. Possibly the male ate some, too. He'd sometimes take them in his mouth, and once didn't spit one back out. So maybe, as it's their first spawn, they haven't got it right yet. It is, after all, a community tank with corys, coolies, and three Amano. The big Amano female is a very effective predator. Which do you suspect the most? The cribs themselves, or the shrimp, or just water conditions that would not allow growth, though in that case, why would the eggs even hatch? Would love feedback on this.
Well, I would say if the fish were already about 2 weeks old, that the water conditions probably weren't the problem, especially since the other fish seem unaffected. I mean, I can't completely rule it out, but I would tend to not suspect that as much. The first culprits, I would say, are the parents, just because it is their first spawn, and you saw the male eat one.
Yeah.
And they usually mess up the first spawn. I mean, that's very common with many cichlids. So
yeah, I think people kind of often take a few batches to figure out how to do it too, but by then you're already grandparents and it's a little late.
True, but we don't eat them. we still keep
them
above
hope
them
not.
Anyway. But
chew on them maybe a little bit because they're dang cute, but not eat them.
Well, so that would be my first inclination, but it sounds like the Amano shrimp can't be ruled out either, especially since there's a tendency in cichlids sometimes that a trait that's a survival characteristic, if the parents notice that they're losing fry to a predator, then often they will eat the rest of the fry thinking, well, not thinking necessarily this, but this is sort of the rationale behind it, is that they want to preserve the protein for themselves, hoping that conditions will improve in the near future and that they can raise another batch, rather than wasting all the resources producing protein for something else to snack on.
Wow.
So that it could be that that's what's happened. The Amanos were picking them off and the fish decided to cut their losses, so to speak.
Yeah.
That does happen. So I wouldn't suspect the corys or coolies as much. So those are my top two, I would say. Corys tend to be really innocuous. Coolies in general, too. I mean, you can't rule anything out. I've seen corys slurp up red cherry shrimp that have just molted, like candy.
Wow.
And it's not like, you know, any fish that can eat something that's tasty usually will.
If it can get it in its mouth, it will
right.
eat it.
But I do think that it's probably the parents and or the Amanos.
Okay. Do we have anything else today? Did you want to tell us something?
I did. I wanted to mention one more thing, and that's that many of you have noticed that I've been releasing the quick guides lately on YouTube to various aquarium-related topics. I'm working on quite a few now. I've got a big queue of them that I'm trying to film so I can release them. But I would just like to say, if you have a particular aquarium topic that you'd like a quick guide on...
Or a how-to?
Yeah, it's basically a how-to that I can do in about 2 minutes or less. On an aquarium topic, if you have one that you would like me to do one on, I may or may not be able to because I don't know everything about aquariums and I may have no idea. But if I do, it would be nice to be able to just know what you're looking for, what you would appreciate, or what you would appreciate if you didn't already know it, so that we can release it for people who might want to know those things. So
suggestions.
Yeah, suggestions basically on what you might want to see in an Aquariumx quick guide.
Indeed. And in the meantime...
Yeah. May the fish...
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.